From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. New York City is taking its first steps toward reopening today, 100 days after confirming its first case of COVID-19 and after nearly 22,000 people died of it in that city. Hundreds of thousands of workers could return to their jobs at factories, construction sites, retail stores. We'll have the latest on COVID-19 in just a moment.
But first, congressional Democrats today are seeking an overhaul of policing in America. They are proposing a new law that would ban chokeholds and some no-knock warrants, limit the transfer of military equipment to local police, and make it easier to track and prosecute police misconduct. Senator Kamala Harris spoke as Democrats unveiled the legislation this morning.
Reform and change must happen, and it must happen now. And let's be clear, reforming policing is in the best interest of all Americans. It is literally in the best interest of all Americans, because this is a basic matter of fairness and, as so many have said, justice.
Representative William Lacey Clay is one of the lawmakers backing this bill. He's a Democrat from Missouri, and he joins us now. And Congressman, what are you trying to accomplish with this bill?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on to talk about what we think will be transformative legislation in the area of policing African-American communities. We are calling for a strong police accountability framework. And the bill takes on some critical issues, such as redefining police misconduct, establishing a national use of force standard, which is part of a bill that Ro Khanna of California and I have co-sponsored for the last 2 years. We also include establishing a national use of force standard and increasing the U.S. Department of Justice's authority to prosecute misconduct by law enforcement officers.
Congressman Lacey Clay, this bill would also, as you mentioned, change the legal standards requiring for disciplining and prosecuting police. But Congress can only do so much about policing because it's largely governed by the state and local level. So how does this bill address that reality?
No, and you're absolutely right, correct about that. But here's what has to happen, and I think most Americans get this, is that at the state, local, and federal level, we have to listen to the American people, and they have demonstrated that through their protests as well as through their feet. When you have millions of Americans going out in the streets voicing their disgust towards the form of policing that inflicts so much pain to the African American community, and this is not just in urban centers. It's in small towns throughout rural America, too. I represent St. Louis, Missouri. But throughout Missouri this past week, in small cities, small towns, neighbors came out to say, first of all, the lynching of George Floyd in Minneapolis was an atrocity that and that the world witnessed. And it should not be. And so I urge any elected official in this nation to listen to the American people.
Congressman, we'll be learning much more about this bill as the days go on, but I want to ask you something else. Republicans were not part of drafting this bill. What are the odds of this passing the Republican-controlled Senate, and what changes would you be willing to accept to get it passed?
Well, let me say this. I have heard from numerous Republican colleagues, my two U.S. senators in Missouri, Republicans from Illinois and across this country, who have said to me, we feel helpless, we want to do something, and we want to be a part of an effort that transforms policing and makes them accountable in this country. So I'm very confident that we will have allies on the other side of the aisle to get this legislation to the finish line and over to the president's desk.
President Trump tweeted today that law and order not defund and abolish the police. With the few seconds that I have left with you, are you afraid that this might become a part of his campaign strategy, that the Democrats are anti-police?
Here's what I think is going to happen to President Trump in this national debate, is that it's already went past him because it's not focused on him and his individuality, but it's focused on a systemic system.
Thank you so much, Congressman William Lacey Clay, a Democrat representing Missouri's 1st Congressional District.
Thank you for having me.
Well, now to COVID-19. New figures from Johns Hopkins show caseloads going up in more than 22 states, and health experts are pointing to those gatherings from a couple weeks ago on Memorial Day weekend. Caroline Buckey is professor of epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. Professor Buckey, your thoughts. We are a couple of weeks past those gatherings. Do you agree they may be to blame?
I think the first thing to say is that it's important to remember that confirmed cases going up sometimes reflect testing capacity changes and the ability to find new cases. So as different states increase their testing, sometimes they're finding more cases. The extent to which that reflects the true epidemic will vary. So there should always be a little bit of caution in interpreting confirmed case counts around the country. Having said that, I think that the uptick in cases that we're seeing in some states seems real. And, the numbers based on hospitalizations and deaths, at least, will be lagged by a couple of weeks. So it's reasonable to assume that that reflects transmission happening in the previous weeks. And I should say that we've been monitoring mobility patterns around the country, and we have seen a gradual increase in mobility and spikes in movement and travel that have happened, associated with the Memorial Day weekend, but also more generally just an uptick in how people are moving around.
Well, but is this tracking through cell phones, not necessarily getting any personal data, but just seeing as they move around? How are you tracking?
Yes, that's based on aggregated data from mobile phones. So it's never individual level, but you can see, say, on a county level that people are starting to travel further and move more frequently.
Well, but staying with Memorial Day weekend, there was concern that a lot of kids, just as they had at spring break, had gone to places like Florida, were partying, we saw the pictures, and then would disperse from there and go home. And now we have college athletes, young people, returning to the field, and some of them are testing positive. Arkansas State reported 7 athletes across different programs tested positive last week, all asymptomatic. They're not showing any signs. Your concerns about kids that are going back, young people are going back to college.
Yes, I think that this is a big concern. We know that the virus spreads best when people are congregated together. We also know that young people are not immune to this virus. They can get the virus, they can transmit the virus. And so when they are coming together in big congregations and then traveling elsewhere, they can spread it when they go. A significant amount of transmission happens before you have symptoms. So it's that pre-symptomatic transmission that is of real concern among these young people.
Well, and that brings us to the protests we're seeing. I mean, we know public health experts have been hand-to-mouth, concerned, even though many of them are out, themselves protesting what they see as an inequity in the treatment of Americans, the difference in health care for Black Americans and white Americans. So many of them are out protesting, health workers. But how concerned are you about the spread as so many people have gathered to protest?
So I think this is obviously a very complicated issue. The reality is that this epidemic has disproportionately impacted communities of color and Black Americans, and that Black Americans face systematic public health inequities. And so the protesters that we're seeing now, most of the organizations behind these protests are trying to protect people as best they can while protesting their rights to adequate public health care. So, you know, this is a very worrying, but at the same time, I think we have to do what we can to protect them. So yeah. We know that, you know, being crowded into jails is one of the highest risk factors for transmission, and we shouldn't be locking people up for protesting. Clearly, there is risk of COVID-19 being spread by these protests. Having said that, we've already seen an uptick in movements around the country that are likely also contributing to transmission. And personally, I think that the reasons for the protests and the efforts being made to social distance reflect a very different set of circumstances than you know, holidaying for Memorial Day weekend.
Caroline Buckey, professor of epidemiology at Harvard. Professor Buckey, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The documentation of both George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery's deaths through cell phone video are part of a larger tradition in protest movements to use technology to prove that allegations of racism and police brutality are real. But the frequency of watching these types of videos can also become a psychological burden. Alyssa Richardson has studied the use of technology in activist movements. She's also a professor at the University of Southern California and author of Bearing Witness While Black, African Americans, Smartphones, and the New Protest Journalism. She joins us now via Skype. Hello and welcome.
Thank you, Tanya, for having me.
Yes. Yeah, so Professor Richardson, you recently wrote an article making the case for treating video and images of Black death like that of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd as sacred. And you note that there's a distinction between social justice and exploitation. Can you say more about this?
Yes, there's a very fine line between using these photographs to further or advance social justice and re-traumatizing African-American communities. When I was doing the research for my book, Bearing Witness While Black, I found three overlapping eras of domestic terror against African-Americans. And during those times, witnessing was used. So I really identify and talk readily about slavery, which then gave way to lynching, which then gave way to the police brutality that we see today. And through each of these overlapping eras, you have Black witnesses who were using technology of the day to report on those injustices. But they were never bandied about in the way that we are constantly scrolling through and stepping over these videos so casually online. And so my essay really called for us to be more thoughtful about that.
I want to talk with you more about that. I also want to delve a little more deeply into your research, which really makes the point that technology and emergent forms of journalism, as you just said, have always been a crucial way for Black Americans to advance civil rights. I'm thinking very specifically about the role that television played during the civil rights movement in the 60s. When I was in journalism school, one thing that really stood out to me was how being able to see racists on television and that moral equivalency that journalists were given to both racists who were spewing hate speech against Black voices asking for basic human rights, the power of that in actually changing the trajectory of that movement at the time. Can you talk more about that?
Absolutely. And I love that you bring up that example, Tanya, because it goes back even farther than that. The slave narratives were the first accurate accounts, first person, of what happened during that horrible time in our history. And Frederick Douglass was the foremost orator and author of that moment. And when he shared what was going on and was one of the most photographed Americans during that time, white Americans, many joined that abolitionist movement with him. One of the things that's most interesting is as you travel through time, you see people like Ida B. Wells, who kept what's called her red record. And she used those newspapers and the magazine called The Crisis, which was the official vein of the NAACP, to show the pictures from really atrocious lynchings. And those kinds of photographs help move the needle in the conversation about just human rights injustices against Black people. And as you begin to come up to more modern times, absolutely. television was an incredible tool to the civil rights movement, because we have to remember that back then, televised news only lasted 15 minutes. We didn't have 24-hour news cycles. And so people like John Lewis and Ann Nash of SNCC knew to use those precious 15 minutes to highlight a sit-in, a march, or any kind of other public demonstration. And they were masterful. They even had their own agency where they would sell their pictures to newspapers and other organizations of their demonstrations. And so they're the first modern Black witnesses in this way. If we think about the 1990s, the very first instance of a handheld camera and not a news camera capturing police brutality would be that of George Holliday using his camera to film Rodney King's beating in 1991. And so from there, there's a huge gap in terms of what we regard as mobile journalists. And in 2009, we have the horrific footage surface of Oscar Grant being shot on a BART platform on New Year's Day. And so that's kind of the trajectory historically of where bearing witness, where while Black has gotten us. We have seen through Black people's lenses for all of these years what's been going on.
Can we talk a little bit more about the murkiness, though, that can emerge? You mentioned the toll that it takes on us seeing these images around the clock. But then what happens, the psychological toll that takes place when the outcomes of us witnessing all of this may not bore out when it goes to the court of law. So several years ago, I did a piece where I sat down with a former police officer and a prosecutor, and we looked at several cell phone videos and police camera videos of what looked like really aggressive actions with police against citizens. And pretty consistently with every video, the police officer and the prosecutor saw different things. The prosecutor was looking for what she could not see, and the officer made the argument that what we were witnessing was in many cases resisting arrest. There are limitations to what video can tell us. Can you talk about this a little bit more?
Absolutely. And if we think back to the Rodney King case, the jury was exposed to slowed down versions of the video. And so the impact and a lot the horror that you saw in that video was blunted when it was picked apart, slowed down, edited, shown without audio. All of these things are documented as having an effect on jurors in terms of being able to question whether that beating was justified or not. We're now entering that same phase as we talk about deep fakes and we think about people feigning certain things. You have people who don't want to believe that these things still exist in the form of police brutality. And you have people asking, well, what happened before the camera started rolling? Did this person actually deserve their demise? And African Americans, in some ways, are the only group that is asked to defend or prove or disprove that they didn't hasten their own demise in some action that appeared off camera. So the danger of relying on these videos too closely is that we can be putting an additional burden on African Americans to show that unless they have that ocular proof, that nothing actually happened. And we only need look toward these cases of Ahmaud Arbery, for example. No one was arrested for 10 whole weeks until a video surfaced. It should not take that much. We should be able to believe Black people the first time, but we're still not at a point where, as a society, if a video does exist, there's no outcry. I think that's part of the trauma that African Americans are experiencing, because on the one hand, while they don't want to see people who look like them beaten over and over again or killed on live television, they do understand that for a broader public, sometimes that is what is necessary to move that needle. And so the trauma that we're talking about is that many African Americans are no longer looking at these videos. They can participate and acknowledge and support a movement without subjecting themselves to that.
I want to ask you about something else. Technology can also be used as a tool of surveillance. We've heard reports that cities are using contact tracing. We know phones track where we are, and social media platforms can be surveilled as well, as interfered with. In your work, how have you seen activists and citizen journalists countering this? I mean, we actually saw some of this in Hong Kong.
Absolutely. One of the gifts of smartphone technology is that you can show who's actually on the ground and show that perhaps, like we've seen in these past few days, it's not just African-Americans who are looting or destroying property, that there are outside actors participating too. So that's one benefit. But the downside to that is the increased surveillance that many state-sponsored agencies are using to make sure that they're following up with anyone that they see on the ground, whether they're engaging in peaceful protest or not. There's a number of facial recognition tools that are being used and matched against for people's social media profiles to make arrests after a protest, whether it's peaceful or not. There's also additional technology that can scan for shoes. And so you're seeing a lot of activists on social media ask, please blur the faces of people and their shoes if you're going to highlight a peaceful protest or take pictures of where you were. And so in the book, I talk about a couple of activists that I actually interviewed who said they were called by their Twitter handle by different police departments as soon as they arrived on the scene. And they said, wow, we are really being surveilled. I'm not even being called by my official name. I'm being called by my Twitter handle. And so there, that's documented in terms of how that's being used. There's also a lot of declassified information that's starting to come out of protesters from the Ferguson uprisings, how they were tracked and trailed for months, even after protests dissipated. So there is a very real risk for bearing witness while Black. It's not something that we should dismiss casually, especially as the witnesses are getting younger and younger. I am very proud of the work that 17-year-old Darnella Frazier undertook when she dared to film George Floyd's killing. I'm also worried, you know, what we're doing to our young witnesses who are going to be subjected to all kinds of harassment.
That's Alyssa Richardson, professor at the University of Southern California and author of Bearing Witness While Black, African Americans, Smartphones, and the New Protest Journalism. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Former U.S. service members are joining the protest movement in American cities, and for some Black veterans, the demonstrations are a chance to find their voice. Colorado Public Radio's Megan Verley reports.
No justice, no peace. Aubrey Rose cuts a striking figure at Denver's ongoing protests. He comes to marches wearing his formal army jacket with all his ribbons and medals. Over his shoulder dangles an upside-down American flag, a symbol of the nation in distress. He says he's proud to see how many people have come out to protest the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis.
The way these police have been behaving, any military service member that would behave like this would be in Leavenworth right now.
Rose spent 18 years in the Army and served combat tours in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Bosnia. He says the protests have given him a new sense of purpose.
And for the first time, as an adult, I'm able to utilize my constitutional rights because I couldn't do it before when I was active duty.
Defense Department rules say service members can't wear their uniforms if they participate in protests. They also can't do anything that seems to disrespect the chain of command, including the president. Those restrictions do go away when you leave the service. But Air Force veteran Leanne Wheeler says by then, many veterans are used to living under them.
I'm sure it's an internal conflict and an internal struggle.
Wheeler is an organizer with the progressive veterans group Common Defense. She calls having vets take part in protests a game changer.
It does make a difference for those who have served the country to be engaged in this conversation. You can't ignore that service, and we bring it full-throated. We've served. Here's what we understand about the Constitution.
While protest is off limits for active duty service members, their commanders have released statements condemning the killing of George Floyd. People of color make up more than 40% of the armed forces. In the National Guard, it's 30%. An African American guardsman in Washington, D.C., recently became a momentary Twitter sensation as he quietly chanted along with demonstrators, "I'm Black and I'm proud."
He's saying it.
Many states, including Colorado, have deployed guard units to try to maintain order. But some worry that will only lead to escalation.
What we're afraid of is history repeating itself of something like Kent State Massacre.
Shauna Foster is with the group About Face. post 9/11 veterans who now organize against U.S. militarism at home and abroad. The group is encouraging guard troops and active duty, if ordered, to refuse to confront protesters.
To be deployed against your own neighbors, to be using those weapons of war against people, civilians, I mean, the military is not really trained for that. We are trained to engage enemy combatants.
Foster says her group has received dozens of calls in recent days from service members worried about being called up against protesters. For those who are deployed, they may find familiar uniforms in the crowd. At a recent protest in Colorado Springs, Iraq War veteran Shanika Mosley attended in a coronavirus mask and her Army dress jacket, which she chose to wear so those around her would know what she had done.
You know, I proudly fought for my country, and I just came out here to wear it today to let everybody know I fought for my country and that they're fighting for our country too.
Mosley says these protests against police brutality and racism are about making sure everyone, with a uniform and without, has a voice. For Here and Now, I'm Megan Verlee.
So let's see, a pandemic, economic collapse, an unarmed black man killed by a seemingly indifferent white police officer knee to his neck, metaphor writ large, pepper spray used to clear peaceful protesters from a park so a president could take a photo op at a church he didn't attend. Not much to laugh about there, or is there? And must we? Let's ask Sarah Cooper. Millions have seen her short videos on Twitter or TikTok wearing a simple navy blazer. In a recent one, a fan blows her hair, you know, the way a helicopter should when you're standing next to it. So picture now this young black woman lip-syncing this.
Yeah, but MAGA is Make America Great Again. By the way, they love African-American people. They love black people. MAGA loves the black people.
They love the black people. Although Trump does not love Sarah, he blocked her on Twitter years before these videos. We'll have all of them at hereandnow.org as Sarah Cooper joins us on Skype from Brooklyn. And Sarah, you know, we've seen those videos where people put their voices in the lips of politicians. This is you lip-syncing the president's words. Why did you start this?
Well, it was a combination of a few things. I was stuck inside my apartment during quarantine. I wanted to figure out what TikTok was. That's going on along with Trump giving these daily press briefings where he's talking a lot but not saying anything. And it really just reminded me of being in corporate meetings where these guys would come in and just throw around a buzzword they just learned 5 minutes ago and they don't even know what it really means. But he had the added benefit of people behind him nodding, reporters calling him Sir, Mr. President. I kind of wanted to take all of that away. And as a black woman who's been in these situations, I was like, I want to be able to do that. I want to be able to BS my way through a response. I like the idea of just lip syncing his words and giving people this visual of what would it be like if a black woman was in a meeting and said something like, yeah, you know, we're going to form a committee. I'm going to call it a committee and we're going to make decisions, which is one of the first videos that I did was him saying that.
And so we're going to have a few committees, I'll call them committees, and then ultimately we're going to make decisions. So we're going to make decisions fairly quickly, and I think they're going to be the correct decision.
And so that was kind of the impetus for it. It was just like, I want to be able to BS my way through life the way the president has BS'd his way through this administration.
Well, and now it should be abundantly clear to anyone for whom it wasn't clear before, you are not a fan of President Trump. He returns the favor. He's blocked you on Twitter.
Well, he blocked me on Twitter 3 years ago. So we've had a tumultuous relationship. And so this actually feels like sort of poetic justice that I am now using him to increase my platform.
So there, it has been established. Not fans. Tell us how this all started. We know you wanted to be an actress at one point. You know, we're doing some stand-up. But you were at Google when you started writing blog posts about how to appear smart at meetings. The posts get attention. You got a deal to write the book, 100 Tricks to Appear Smart in Meetings, How to Get By Without Even Trying. Can you give us some of those tips?
Absolutely. One of my favorite tips is to translate percentages into fractions. So if someone says 25% of people clicked on this button, you just respond with, oh, about 1 in 4. And people will be so impressed with your extremely quick math skills. Another great one is just to ask, will this scale? No matter what it is, just ask if it's going to scale, because scaling is very important and no one even really knows what that means. And another great one, which is you don't even have to say anything, is just to get up from the conference room table and start pacing around the room. I remember being in a meeting and a VP got up, started pacing around the room, and then asked the presenter to go back one slide, which is another one of the tricks. And he did both of those things at the same time. And then he looked over at me and he winked. And so that's proof to me that that's how you become a VP at Google, is you just pace, ask the presenter to go back a slide, make fun of yourself, draw a Venn diagram, translate percentages into fractions, and you will immediately make everyone in the room think that you are leadership material.
Okay, will this scale, pace? So what do you do with your face? Like, do you rehearse in a mirror? Are you trying to copy his face? What are you doing?
That's one thing I'm specifically not trying to do, because he doesn't actually emote with his face a lot. What I'm doing is I'm saying, what if me, Sarah Cooper, said these words? And I'm sort of speaking to the subtext of what he's saying. So when he is obviously out of his element, I am making a face like I'm confused, or I'm reaching, or I'm stretching, or I'm grasping for a word. I'm very specifically not doing what he's doing, but doing what a normal human being would be doing if they were saying these words.
It looks like you have been an observer, and maybe an observer of those who puff up a bit for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I had a life coach very briefly a few years ago, and one of the things we did was write a personal mantra, or a thing that we want to get across with our work. And the thing that I wrote for myself was to pull back the mask and show that a lot of us really don't know what we're doing. I mean, me included. You see people doing things on social media and you think, oh, they're successful. I'll do that same thing. I'll post that same picture. I'll write that same caption. And it's so empty. And so that's why we're sort of starved for authenticity, because a lot of us are just playing parts.
Well, and now we have COVID-19. Thank God we had doctors and nurses who actually trained and are helping us through this. And let's talk about your video about that. This was How to Medical, and these were President Trump's comments at that press briefing in which Dr. Deborah Birx, who's the response coordinator for the coronavirus task force, he tried to get her to say that the virus could be attacked by hitting the body with ultraviolet light, and he was pointing at his body. Maybe we inject disinfectant into the body or lungs. And picture, again, a black woman in her blazer. This time, you're like, I think you had a lamp. You were putting a lamp on your skin, taking a bottle of Clorox, I think, and acting like you could inject it into your skin. Let's listen.
We hit the body with a tremendous, whether it's ultraviolet or just very powerful light. And I think you said that hasn't been checked, but you're going to test it. And then I said, supposing you brought the light inside the body.
What are you thinking when you're doing this? Because it was not just absurd. It was dangerous.
When I was doing this, I was thinking, I'm being really smart right now. I'm saying the smartest possible thing that I think I can possibly say right now, which is, I think, what Trump was thinking when he was saying it. He thought he was changing the game with his ideas of putting ultraviolet light underneath the skin. Taking that idea of brilliance and then juxtaposing it with me being underneath my kitchen sink, pulling out the cleaner, putting it on my arm, injecting it into my arm. I really think this is smart, but it's so obviously stupid.
Now we have the killing of George Floyd. You know, it's hard to think of anything there, but after the president had those protesters forcibly, violently removed from Lafayette Park, peaceful protesters, so he could walk to that photo op at the church, you came back with an audio from a 2015 Bloomberg News interview about the Bible. Let's listen.
I'm wondering what one or two of your most favored Bible verses are,
well,
and why.
I wouldn't want to get into it, because to me that's very personal. You know, when I talk about the Bible, it's very personal. So I don't want to get into
There's no verse that means a lot to you that you think about or cite?
The Bible means a lot to me, but I don't want to get into specifics.
Even to cite a verse that
no,
you like?
No, I don't want to do that.
You're Old Testament guy or a New Testament guy?
Probably equal. I think it's just an incredible... The whole
Sarah Cooper.
Bible is an incredible...
There is also a passage in the Bible about not being a hypocrite. Never hold up your faith in front of others. Go do it privately. But having said that, you've said that some of President Trump's supporters have loved these. But when it comes to this moment that we're in now, how are you feeling when you're doing these things?
It's such a difficult time. I think for me, creating things is part of what helps me with my anxiety about what's going on and my uncertainty and my hopelessness. And I never thought that doing something like this would actually be helpful. And I've been shocked, really, by the outpouring of people that have said, I haven't laughed all week, and I saw your video, and I laughed for the first time, or I got off a shift, you know, as a nurse, and I smiled when I saw this. And so it is a tendency for me to be like, well, is this important? Am I making a difference at all? But when I get messages like that, I realize, you know, humor is important. Laughing is important, and it's healing. And so as hard as everything is right now, I do think that there is something to be said for making things that people can have some release with.
Comedian Sarah Cooper, and we'll have all of her Twitter and TikTok videos at hearnow.org. Sarah, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A new book for young readers has a modern take on some familiar fantasy creatures and takes on a deeper resonance in light of current events. In Greek mythology, sirens lured sailors to their doom with the power of their voices. In Bethany Murrow's A Song Below Water, Tavia is a siren, but she's also a black teenager living in Portland who has been told she must hide the power of her voice. It could put her in danger. Fortunately, Tavia has her best friend, Effie, who also has some magical powers of her own. Bethany Murrow joins me now. And Bethany, you say A Song Below Water came from a DM exchange that you had about sirens being black girls. Tell us more.
Well, the first message, the first direct message was actually my voice's power. And I was talking to my sister, Jennifer, who lives in Portland, Oregon, and we were watching a black woman being completely abused online, as is sort of common, unfortunately. And while all of these trolls and awful people were raining down this abuse on her, they were telling her it was because nobody cared what she had to say. And obviously, that's very difficult to believe when what she said incited such vitriol in such large quantities. Mm. And so I said to my sister, my voice is power, because we know better. And from saying my voice is power, I said, that sounds like something a black girl siren would say. And then I said, what if only black girls are sirens?
And in the book, we learn right away the power of Tavia's voice puts her in danger. There's a news report of a woman who was murdered, whose murder is seen by some as justified because she might have been a siren.
The point of that and the reason that was so important for me to include is because not all black women are sirens in this world, but all sirens are black women. And that gives a very convenient cover to people who want to abuse black women. In the book, the defense is the one who brings up the possibility that she was a siren. Yeah. And of course, there's no way to test that. There's no way to prove that or disprove that. The point is, it's enough to just posit it. And we see that with every black woman who has been killed, particularly by police officers. They're never the right kind of victim. They never deserve justice. You know, there's always something else we can learn about them that will explain to us why this extrajudicial death sentence was okay.
You chose this to be a young adult reader's book. It could have easily been a novel for adults. Why specifically for young people?
Specifically for black girls. I think that they are living in a horrific time. I think that there's been a pendulum swing where what teenage black children are going through right now more closely resembles my father's generation. And my father was born in 1944, Illinois. And I don't think that I lived in some idyllic time period, but I can absolutely observe that there is a level of constant terror and constant awareness that your life can be taken that I don't remember having.
Yeah. I want to also ask you about Effie, who is also a character. She also seems to be in some sort of danger. from something we don't know much about, though we sense she has magic as well. Why was it important that we not know much about Effie's powers as opposed to Tavia's?
It was really important to me to have these two characters who love and understand each other so much and have this deep relationship and yet are going through two very different journeys. And I wanted Effie to be the kind of character who she does not understand. She does not know what's happening. And I wanted her to have that because I think that it's so unfair to expect that Black children are never innocent, are never, and I mean innocent in the way of just having, being able to not know and being able to say, I don't get this. I don't understand this. I don't want every Black child to have to be the professor at some point in their classroom to explain the world to other people and explain their experiences, though we've just been forced from the age of consciousness to know and understand things that take away our childhood, basically.
You're talking about your work. This work is for young Black girls. And I hear in your voice the determination to make certain that it gets to these young Black girls. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard right now.
I wish that this were just fantasy. And the devastating part, obviously, is that I have used sort of mythological creatures to demonstrate something that otherwise most of my countrymen seem completely unwilling to acknowledge. I think that that's the power of science fiction and fantasy, and I think that's why Black authors have always been the vanguard for it, is we understand that it is closer to the truth than contemporary work is allowed to be.
Thank you so much for your work, Bethany.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.